5.5 million years have been shown to be forced by the changes in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, it would be possible to predict when the next glacial period will begin, if there were no anthropogenic effects involved. According to the model predictions by Berger and Loutre, 2002, at the Université Catholique de Louvain in Belgium, we do not need to worry about another ice age for at least 5,000 years. Indeed, if their model is correct and atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations double, then global warming would postpone the next ice age for another 45,000 years. Paleoclimate work has also provided us with worrying insights into how the climate system works. Recent work on the ice cores and deep-sea sediments demonstrate that at least regional climate changes of 5 degrees Celsius can occur in a matter of decades. This work on reconstructing past climate seems to demonstrate that the global climate system is not benign, but highly dynamic and prone to rapid changes. The rise of the environmental social movement. The next change that occurred during the 1980s was a massive grassroots expansion in the environmental movement, particularly in the USA, Canada, and the UK, partly as a backlash against the right-wing governments of the 1980s and the expansion of the consumer economy, and partly because of the increasing number of environment-related stories in the media. This heralded a new era of global environmental awareness and transnational NGOs, non-governmental organizations. The roots of this growing environmental awareness can be tracked back to a number of key markers. These include the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962, the image of Earth seen from the moon in 1969, the Club of Rome's 1972 report on Limits to Growth, the Three Mile Island nuclear reactor accident in 1979, and the nuclear accident at Chernobyl in 1986, and the Exxon Valdez oil spillage in 1989. But these environmental problems were all regional in effect, limited geographically to the specific area in which they occurred. It was the discovery in 1985 by the British Antarctic Survey of depletion of ozone over Antarctica, which demonstrated the global connectivity of our environment. The ozone hole also had a tangible international cause, the use of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, which led to a whole new area of politics, the international management of the environment. There followed a set of key agreements: the 1985 Vienna Convention for the Protection of the Ozone Layer, the 1987 Montreal Protocol on Substances that Deplete the Ozone Layer, and the 1990 London and 1992 Copenhagen Adjustments and Amendments to the Protocol. These have been held up as examples of successful environmental diplomacy. Climate change has had a slower development in international politics, and far less has been achieved in terms of regulation and implementation. This is, at its most simplistic level, because of the great inherent uncertainties of the science and the greater economic costs involved. Global warming and the media. The other reason for the acceptance of the global warming hypothesis was the intense media interest throughout the late 1980s and 1990s. This is because the global warming hypothesis was perfect for the media, a dramatic story about the end of the world as we know it, with significant controversy about whether it was even true. Annabella Carvalho, now at the University of Minho, Braga, Portugal, has undertaken a fascinating study of the British quality broadsheet press coverage of the global warming issue between 1985 and 1997. She concentrated particularly on The Guardian and The Times, and found throughout this period that they promoted very different worldviews. Interestingly, despite their differing views, the number of articles published per year by the British quality papers followed a similar pattern and peaked when key IPCC reports were published or international conferences on climate change were held. But it is the nature of these articles that shows how the global warming debate was constructed in the media. From the late 1980s, The Times, which published most articles on global warming in 1989, 1990, and 1992, cast doubt on the claims of climate change. There was a recurrent attempt to promote mistrust in science through strategies of generalization, of disagreement within the scientific community, and, most importantly, discrediting scientists and scientific institutions. A very similar viewpoint was taken by the majority of the American media throughout much of the 1990s. In fact, it has been claimed that this approach in the American media has led to a barrier between scientists and the public in the USA. In the UK, the Guardian newspaper took the opposite approach to that of the Times. Although the Guardian gave space to the technical side of the debate, it soon started to discuss scientific claims in the wider context. As scientific uncertainty regarding the enhanced greenhouse effect decreased during the 1990s, the Guardian coherently advanced a strategy of building confidence in science, with an emphasis on consensus as a means of enhancing the reliability of knowledge. This was because The Guardian understood and promoted one of the fundamental bases of science, which is that a theory, such as global warming, can only be accepted or rejected by the weight of evidence. So, as evidence from many different areas of science continues to support the theory of global warming, so correspondingly, our confidence in the theory should increase. Far from painting science as pure or correct, instead, The Guardian politicized it to demonstrate the bias that is inherent in all science. This clearly showed that many of the climate change claims were being eroded by lobbying pressure, mainly associated with the fossil fuel industry. This politicizing of science allowed The Guardian to strengthen its readers' confidence in science. Moreover, The Guardian clearly conveyed the uncertainties within the science of global warming, and the paper's editors were, and still are, in favor of the precautionary principle. It was through this media filter that scientists attempted to advance their particular global warming view, by either making claims for more research or promoting certain political options. From the late 1980s onwards, scientists became very adept at staging their media performances, and it is clear that the general acceptance of the global warming hypothesis is in part due to their continued efforts to communicate their findings. Indeed, both the skeptical and the supportive stances of The Times and The Guardian, respectively, so legitimized the debate over global warming that the public became aware that this was not an overnight news story, but something that was to become part of the very fabric of our society. It seems that the media has also influenced our use of words. From 1988 onwards, the use of the phrases global warming and climate change gained support, while greenhouse effect lost its appeal and by 1997 was rarely mentioned. The change in terminology is reflected in this book. The title is Global Warming, as everyone knows what that means, and the major discussions in this book are about the climate change it might induce. As mentioned, in the USA, media coverage has been different. First, until recently, there has been no pro-global warming media coverage equivalent to that delivered by The Guardian. Second, climate change skeptics have been very strong on using the media in the USA. For example, McIntyre and McKittrick in 2003 attacked the global mean temperature hockey stick by raising questions about the quality of data and accuracy of methods used to estimate trends in GMT. This debate has taken place between experts, but in an unusually public manner. For example, one U.S. scientist, Michael Mann, who has widely published on global mean temperature trends, has been the center of the criticism, and active in responding to it. Despite man's strong rebuttal and the weight of scientific evidence that brings into doubt the validity of the critique, both the media and U.S. and British politicians have continued to bring attention to the questions raised by McIntyre and McKittrick. There are two possible explanations for this extraordinarily media-facilitated public scientific debate. First, political skeptics who do not want to see political action to address climate change may be using this debate about methods and scientific uncertainty as a convenient hook on which to hang their case for delay. The global mean temperature curve over the last millennium is a particularly important target for such criticism, owing to its emblematic role in the policy debate. Second, the media's ethical commitment to balanced reporting may unwittingly provide unwarranted attention to critical views, even if they are marginal and outside the realm of what is normally considered good science. In the UK, The Guardian opened up the critical coverage by examining the motivations behind the science, thus providing the contested space within which reporting takes place. This, however, did not occur in the U.S. or elsewhere in the world until very recently. The McIntyre and McKittrick case thus demonstrates the public nature of scientific enterprise, especially on issues that are politically relevant. When combined with greater ease of communication from conventional media such as newspapers, radio, and television, to more informal websites, what is normally a relatively private debate among scientists and experts can easily be shifted into the public arena. Overall, such exchanges contribute to a public impression that the science of global warming is contested, despite what many would argue is an overwhelmingly strong scientific case that global warming is occurring and human activity is a main driver of this change. In the USA, perhaps more powerful than newspaper coverage have been other forms of media that rely on visual information, such as film, television, and the internet. Researchers have studied the effects of the 2004 Hollywood blockbuster film The Day After Tomorrow. With a huge viewing public, estimated at 21 million people in the USA alone, The Day After Tomorrow was a commercial success and also appears to have helped to promote climate change from an obscure scientific issue to one of popular public concern. In addition, the media coverage in glossy magazines, for example in Time magazine in April 2006 and Vanity Fair in May 2006, has begun to convey a greater sense of urgency about climate change. Finally, widespread media coverage of emblematic impacts of climate change has also been stimulated by the international release of the documentary film An Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore, and by a growing number of television documentaries on climate change, such as 60 Minutes, ABC News, and HBO documentaries in 2006. This rise in visual media coverage suggests that in the last decade, the availability heuristics for promoting public understanding of climate change have risen dramatically. The economists weighed in. Economists have been involved with studying climate change from the very beginning of the IPCC process. There are two landmark publications that have had very different effects on the global warming debate. First, there was the publication of the controversial book The Skeptical Environmentalist by Bjorn Lomborg in English in 2001. In this and subsequent books, he argues that the cost of cutting global greenhouse emissions is extremely high, and that those who suffer most from the effects of climate change are those in the poorest countries. He argues that a better use of this money would be poverty alleviation and rapid development of the third world. As he suggests, if you are starving, you are not worried about the state of the planet for your children. You are worrying solely about having them at all. This view, as you can imagine, was highly controversial. The second major landmark was the publication of the UK government-commissioned Stern Report on the Economics of Climate Change in 2006. Cambridge University Press version, first published in 2007. The report was led by Sir Nicholas Stern, then the advisor to the UK government on the economics of climate change and development, reporting to the Prime Minister, then Tony Blair. The report states that if we do nothing, then the impacts of climate change could cost between 5% and 20% of world GDP every year. That means the whole world loses one-fifth of what it earns to address the impacts. This, of course, puts climate change impacts on a completely different economic scale than was envisaged by Lomborg. This dire view of the future has been supported by a recent commentary by Martin Perry and colleagues in the journal Nature, June 2008. But the Stern report does present some good news, because if we do everything we can to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions and ensure we adapt to the coming effects of climate change, this will cost us only 1% of world GDP every year. The Stern report has been criticized on specifics by other economists. For example, does it use the right inherent discount rate? This is the rate economists use to take into account that consumption inherently has a lower value in the future than in the present. This is because future consumption should be discounted simply because it takes place in the future, and people generally prefer the present to the future. For example, William Nordhaus used inherent discount rates of up to 3%, which means an environmental benefit occurring 25 years in the future is worth about half as much as the same benefit today. Stern argued that inherent discount rates were ethically inappropriate. The Stern report has also been criticized for being overly optimistic about the costs of adapting to a low-carbon world. Roger Pielke Jr. and colleagues in the journal Nature, April 2008, present a case that emission scenarios used by the IPCC 2007 are too low, and thus the technological and political challenge, and thus the cost, would be much higher. In June 2008, Sir Nicholas Stern did revise his estimated costs up to 2% of world GDP. Not because of these criticisms, but because global warming was occurring faster than expected. Nevertheless, the Stern report sent seismic waves around the world. In the UK, most of my colleagues see the Stern report and the winter of 2006-2007 as the turning point when the public decided that climate change was real. It was as if people said to themselves, if the economists are worried about the cost of climate change, it must be real. Summary. So, a combination of several factors. One, the science of global warming essentially carried out by the mid-1960s. Two, the hockey stick upturn in the global temperature data set, which was first observed at the end of the 1980s. Three, our increased knowledge in the 1980s of how past climate has reacted to changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide. Four, our greater ability in the late 1970s and 1980s to model future changes in climate with supercomputers. 5. The emergence of global environmental awareness in the late 1980s. 6. The media's savage engagement in the confrontational nature of the debate and the huge interest in what some of my colleagues call climate porn. And 7. Politicians and economists taking the threat of climate change seriously since the late 1990s has led finally to recognition and acceptance of the global warming hypothesis. Over the same period, thousands of scientists have turned their attention to understanding global warming. Landmarks have been the setting up of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, in 1988, by the United Nations Environmental Panel and World Meteorological Organization, the publication of key reports by the IPCC in 1990, 1996, 2001, and 2007, the formal signature of the United Nations Framework Commission on Climate Change, UNFCCC, at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, the subsequent Conference of the Parties, COP, at Kyoto in 1998, where the UNFCCC protocols were formally accepted. The agreement of the Kyoto Protocols in Bonn in July 2001, and the ratification of the Kyoto Protocol on 16 February 2005. Chapter 3. What is the evidence for climate change? Past climate change. Climate change in the geological past has been reconstructed using a number of key archives, including marine and lake sediments, ice cores, cave deposits, and tree rings. These various records reveal that over the last 100 million years, the Earth's climate has been cooling down, moving from the so-called greenhouse world of the Cretaceous period, when dinosaurs enjoyed warm and gentle conditions, through to the cooler and more dynamic icehouse world of today. It may seem odd that in geological terms our planet is extremely cold, while this whole book is concerned with our great fears of global warming. This is because the very fact that there are huge ice sheets on both Antarctica and Greenland, and nearly permanent sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, makes the global climate very sensitive to changes in greenhouse gases. This long-term 100-million-year transition to colder global climate conditions was driven mainly by tectonic changes. These included the opening of the Tasmanian-Antarctic Gateway and the Drake Passage, which isolated Antarctica from the rest of the world, the uplift of the Himalayas, and the closure of the Panama Ocean Gateway. There is also geological evidence that this cooling has been accompanied by a massive drop in the levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide. For example, 100 million years ago, during the time of the dinosaurs, atmospheric carbon dioxide levels could have been as much as 5 times higher than today. These changes culminated in the glaciation of Antarctica about 35 million years ago, and then the Great Northern Hemisphere Ice Ages, which began 2.5 million years ago. Since the beginning of the Great Northern Ice Ages, the global climate has cycled from conditions that were similar or even slightly warmer than today to full ice ages, which caused ice sheets over 3 kilometers thick to form over much of North America and Europe. Between 2.5 and 1 million years ago, these glacial-interglacial cycles occurred every 41,000 years, and since 1 million years ago, they have occurred every 100,000 years. These great ice age cycles are driven primarily by changes in the Earth's orbit with respect to the Sun. In fact, the world has spent over 80% of the last 2.5 million years in conditions colder than the present. Our present interglacial, the Holocene period, started about 10,000 years ago and is an example of the rare warm conditions that occur between each ice age. The Holocene began with the rapid and dramatic end of the last ice age. In less than 4,000 years, global temperatures increased by 6 degrees Celsius, relative sea level rose by 120 meters, atmospheric carbon dioxide increased by one-third, and atmospheric methane doubled. It may seem strange in a book about global warming to suggest that we are currently in a geological ice house world. This is, however, an important point when we look at the consequences of the world warming up, because, despite being in a relatively warm interglacial period, both poles are still glaciated, which is a rare occurrence in the geological history of our planet. Antarctica and Greenland are covered by ice sheets, and the majority of the Arctic Ocean is covered with sea ice. This means that there is a lot of ice that could melt in a warmer world, and, as we will see, this is one of the biggest unknowns that the future holds for our planet. The two glaciated poles also make the temperature gradient, or difference between the poles and the equator, extremely large. From an average of about positive 30 degrees Celsius at the equator, down to negative 35 degrees Celsius or colder at the poles. This temperature gradient is one of the main reasons that we have a climate system, as excess heat from the tropics is exported both via the oceans and the atmosphere to the poles, which causes our weather. Geologically, we currently have one of the largest equator-pole temperature gradients, which leads to a very dynamic climate system. So our ice house conditions cause our very energetic weather system, which is characterized by hurricanes, tornadoes, extratropical temperate winter storms, and monsoons. James Lovelock, in his book The Ages of Gaia, New Edition 1995, page 227, suggests that interglacials, like the Holocene period, are the fevered state of our planet, which clearly, over the last 2.5 million years, prefers a colder average global temperature. Lovelock sees global warming as humanity just adding to the fever. Climate, however, has not been constant during our interglacial, that is, over the last 10,000 years. Paleoclimate evidence suggests that the early Holocene was warmer than the 20th century. Throughout the Holocene, there have been millennial-scale climate events called Dansgaard-Esker cycles, which involve a local cooling of 2 degrees Celsius. These events have had a significant influence on classical civilizations. For example, the cold, arid event about 4,000 years ago coincides with the collapse of many classical civilizations, such as the Old Kingdom in Egypt. The last of these millennial climate cycles was the Little Ice Age. This event is really two cold periods. The first follows the medieval warm period, which ended 1,000 years ago, and is often correspondingly referred to as the medieval cold period. The medieval cold period played a role in extinguishing Norse colonies on Greenland and caused famine and mass migration in Europe. It started gradually before AD 1200 and ended at about AD 1650. The second cold period, more classically referred to as the Little Ice Age, may have been the most rapid and largest change in the North Atlantic region during the late Holocene, as suggested by ice core and deep-sea sediment records. However, it is clear from records around the globe that the Little Ice Age and the medieval warm period occurred only in Northern Europe, Northeast America, and Greenland. Whenever the Little Ice Age is mentioned, so too are the symbolic ice fairs that were held on the River Thames. However, the freezing of the River Thames had as much to do with the sluggish flow of the river until the Port of London was built in the 1800s as the colder temperatures. There are four main data sets which have attempted to reconstruct temperatures for the Northern Hemisphere over the last millennium: tree rings, corals, ice cores, and/or the direct measurement of past temperatures from boreholes. First, it should be noted that the different data sets compare well with each other, which gives added confidence that we are seeing real temperature variations in these reconstructions. Second, the data show that the centuries before 1900 were much colder. They also show that the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age did occur, but that in much of the Northern Hemisphere, little climate change can be seen, with the exception of Northern Europe. Without this last millennium data, the instrumental temperature data set for the last 150 years would have no context. As it is, it can now be clearly shown that temperatures, at least for the Northern Hemisphere, have been warmer in the 20th century than at any other time during the last 1,000 years, revealing the so-called hockey stick. Recent climate change. The three main indicators of global warming are temperature, precipitation, and sea level. One of the key aims of scientists over the last couple of decades has been to estimate how these have changed since the Industrial Revolution and to see if there is any evidence for global warming being to blame. The following is the evidence for each of these parameters. Temperature. As we have seen, temperatures for the Northern Hemisphere have been reconstructed for the last 1,000 years, providing a context to the 20th century. Temperatures for the last 150 years have been estimated from a number of sources, both direct thermometer-based indicators and proxy-based. What is a proxy? As used here and elsewhere, it is short for proxy variable. The term proxy is commonly used to describe a stand-in or substitute, as in proxy vote or fighting by proxy. In the same way, proxy variable, in the parlance of climatology, means a measurable descriptor that stands in for a desired but unobservable variable, such as past ocean or land temperature. So there is an assumption that you can use the proxy variable to estimate a climatic variable that you cannot measure directly. So, as we will see, you can use the thickness of tree rings as a way of estimating past land temperatures. In this case, the tree ring thickness is a proxy for temperature. Thermometer-based indicators include sea surface temperature, SST, marine air temperatures, MAT, land surface air temperature, and temperatures in the free atmosphere, such as those measured by sensors on balloons. Borehole temperature measurements are defined as proxy-based because, despite the use of direct measurements of temperatures, these have been altered over time. Mathematical inversion procedures are required to translate the modern temperature in the boreholes into changes of ground temperature back through time. Other proxy-based methods include infrared satellite measurements and tree ring width and thickness. Thermometer-based measurements of air temperature have been recorded at a number of sites in North America and Europe as far back as 1760. The number of observation sites does not increase to sufficient worldwide geographical coverage to permit a global land average to be calculated until about the middle of the 19th century. SST and marine air temperatures were systematically recorded by ships from the mid-19th century, but even today the coverage of the southern hemisphere is extremely poor. All these data sets require various corrections to account for changing conditions and measurement techniques. For example, for land data, each station has been examined to ensure that conditions have not varied through time as a result of changes in the measurement site, instruments used, instrument shelters, or the way monthly averages were computed, or the growth of cities around the sites, which leads to warmer temperatures caused by the urban heat island effect. In the IPCC 2007 science report, the influence of the urban heat island is acknowledged as real but negligible for the global temperature compilation, less than 0.006 degrees Celsius. For SST and MAT, there are a number of corrections that have to be applied. First, up to 1941, most SST temperature measurements were made in seawater hoisted on deck in a bucket. Since 1941, most measurements have been made at the ship's engine water intakes. Second, between 1856 and 1910, there was a shift from wooden to canvas buckets, which changes the amount of cooling caused by evaporation that occurs as the water is being hoisted on deck. In addition, through this period, there was a gradual shift from sailing ships to steamships, which altered the height of the ship decks and the speed of the ships, both of which can affect the evaporative cooling of the buckets. The other key correction that has to be made is for the global distribution of meteorological stations through time, which has varied greatly since 1870. But by making these corrections, it is possible to produce a continuous record of global surface temperature for the last 100 years, 1906 to 2005, which shows a global warming of 0.74 degrees Celsius plus or minus 0.05 degrees Celsius over this period. What is so interesting about the 130-year temperature data set are the details, particularly as mentioned before the cooling observed in the 1960s and 1970s. One of the key tests for climate models used to predict future climate changes is whether they can reproduce the changes seen since 1870. These models are discussed in more detail in the next chapter, but it should be noted that only by combining natural forcing, such as solar 11-year cycles and stratospheric aerosols from explosive volcanic eruptions, and anthropogenic forcing, greenhouse gases and sulfur aerosols, can the temperature record be simulated. For the last 40 years, balloon data have been available. In 1958, an initial network of 540 stations was set up to release Raywinsons, or balloons, which were regularly released to measure temperature, relative humidity, and pressure through the atmosphere to a height of about 20 kilometers, where they burst. By the 1970s, the network had grown to 700 to 800 stations, reporting twice daily. The balloon dataset shows a general surface and lower troposphere warming over the last 30 years of about 0.1 to 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade, which compares well with the instrumental record, which has a trend over the last 50 years of 0.13 degrees Celsius per decade. Satellite-based proxy records have been available for the last 20 years and have been the source of some key controversies in the global warming debate. The advantage of satellite-mounted microwave sensors is that they have a global coverage, unlike the balloons which are predominantly land-based and in the Northern Hemisphere. There are, however, some major problems with the microwave dataset. First, the temperature record is based on 8 different satellites, and despite overlapping measurement times, intercalibration between different instruments is problematic. Second, there is a spurious warming trend after 1990 of 0.03 to 0.04 degrees Celsius, which is due to a drift in the orbital times, and a spurious cooling trend of 0.12 degrees Celsius per decade due to the reduced altitude or height of the satellites caused by friction with the atmosphere. Third, the height within the atmosphere at which the microwave sensor measures temperature is affected by the amount of ice crystals and raindrops in the atmosphere. Hence, if the planet is warming up, moisture will be found at great altitude, and the microwave sensor would in fact measure temperature much higher in the atmosphere, that is, in the colder parts of the troposphere, thus giving a smaller temperature increase than that which actually occurred. It is unsurprising that reports on satellite-recorded global temperature trends for the last 30 years have changed, as every new paper published contains yet another correction that must be considered. For example, huge controversy occurred when Christie and colleagues in 1995 deduced a global mean cooling trend of 0.05 degrees Celsius per decade for the period 1979 through 1994, but obtained a warming trend of 0.09 degrees Celsius per decade over this period by removing the effects of El Niño and the climatic effect of the eruption of Mount Pinatubo. When the data set is corrected for decreasing satellite altitude, the global mean cooling turns into a warming of 0.07 degrees Celsius per decade. If the balloon, surface, and satellite data are compared, there is some agreement, and they show that the surface and lower troposphere have been warming up, while the stratosphere has been cooling down. The IPCC collation of the published land surface air and sea surface temperatures from 1850 to 2005 includes all the corrections previously discussed. These data are shown relative to the average temperature between 1961 and 1990, and there has been a sharp warming from the start of the 1980s onwards. The mean global surface temperature has increased by 0.74 degrees Celsius, plus or minus 0.05 degrees Celsius, over the last 100 years, 1906 to 2005, and by 0.76 degrees Celsius since 1850, if the average between 1850 and 1899 and 2001 and 2005 is taken. Indirect indicators, such as borehole temperatures and glacier shrinkage, provide independent support for the observed warming. It is also noted by the IPCC, 2007, that the warming has not been globally uniform. warming in the Arctic has been double the global rate in recent decades. Precipitation. There are two global precipitation data sets, HULM and the Global Historical Climate Network, GHCN. Unfortunately, unlike temperature, rainfall and snow data are not as well documented and the records have not been carried out for as long. It is also known that precipitation over land tends to be underestimated by up to 10 to 15%, owing to the effects of airflow around the collecting dish. Without correction of this effect, there is a spurious upward trend in global precipitation. After correction, there seems to be no statistically significant increase of global precipitation. However, there is clear evidence that since the 1980s, atmospheric water content has increased over the land and ocean, as well as in the upper troposphere. This is consistent with the extra water vapor that the warmer atmosphere can hold. Though no discernible global trend in precipitation can be found at the moment, there is good evidence of significant regional changes. The IPCC reports that significant increases in precipitation have occurred in the eastern parts of North and South America, Northern Europe, and Northern and Central Asia. It seems that seasonality of precipitation is also changing. For example, in the high latitudes in the Northern Hemisphere, with increased rainfall in the winter and a decrease in the summer. Long-term drying trends have been observed on Sahel in the Mediterranean, Southern Africa, and parts of Southern Asia. It has also been observed that the amount of rain falling during heavy, extreme rain events has increased, for example, in the USA, Europe, the former Soviet Union, and China. Relative global sea level. The IPCC has also put together a key data set of sea level. It shows that over the last 100 years, the global sea level has risen by about 12 to 22 centimeters. Sea level change is difficult to measure, as relative sea level changes have been derived from two very different data sets, tide gauges and satellites. In the conventional tide gauge system, the sea level is measured relative to a land-based tide gauge benchmark. The major problem is that the land surface is much more dynamic than one would expect, with a lot of vertical movements, and these become incorporated into the measurements. Vertical movements can occur as a result of normal geological compaction of delta sediments, the withdrawal of groundwater from coastal aquifers, both of which are discussed in more detail in Chapter 5 in the coastline section. Uplift associated with colliding tectonic plates, the most extreme of which is mountain building, such as in the Himalayas, or ongoing post-glacial rebound and compensation elsewhere associated with the end of the last ice age. The latter is caused by the rapid removal of weight when the giant ice sheets melted, so that the land that has been weighed down slowly rebounds back to its original position. An example of this is Scotland, which is rising at a rate of 3 millimeters per year, while England is still sinking at a rate of 2 millimeters per year, despite the Scottish ice sheet having melted 10,000 years ago. In comparison, the simple problem with the satellite data is that it is too short, with the best data starting in January 1993, and this means it has to be combined with the tide gauge data to look at long-term trends. However, the 1993 to 2007 data clearly show an increase of over 40 millimeters in global sea level. In summary, between 1961 and 2003, the global average sea level rose by 1.8 millimeters per year, with the fastest rate being observed between 1993 and 2003 of 3.1 millimeters per year. The 1993 to 2003 rate is made up of the following contributions. Thermal expansion of the ocean contributed 1.6 millimeters per year, approximately 50%. Antarctic ice sheet, 0.21 millimeters, approximately 7%. Greenland ice sheet, 0.21 millimeters, approximately 7%, and glaciers and other ice caps, 0.77 millimeters per year, approximately 25%, with approximately 0.3 millimeters per year, 10%, unaccounted for. These new data clearly show that the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets have contributed to recent sea level rise. This is important because one of the biggest unknowns of global warming is how much the massive ice sheets over Greenland and Antarctica will melt. A key indicator of the expansion or contraction of these ice sheets is the sea ice that surrounds them. The state of the cryosphere, or the global ice, is extremely important, as shrinking of ice on land causes the sea level to rise. Unfortunately, submarines have already recorded a worrying thinning of the polar ice caps. Sea ice draft is the thickness of the part of the ice that is submerged under the sea. In order to understand the effects of global warming on the cryosphere, it is important to measure how much ice is melting in the polar regions. Comparison of sea ice draft data acquired on submarine cruises between 1993 and 1997 with similar data acquired between 1958 and 1976 indicates that the mean ice draft at the end of the melt season has decreased by about 1.3 meters in most of the deep water portions of the Arctic Ocean, from 3.1 meters in 1958 to 1.8 meters in the 1990s. In summary, ice draft in the 1990s is over a meter thinner than four decades earlier. The main draft has decreased from over 3 meters to less than 2 meters, and the volume is down by some 40%. In addition, in 2000, for the first time in recorded history, a hole large enough to be seen from space opened in the sea ice above the North Pole. In 2007, satellites revealed the biggest retreat of Arctic sea ice ever recorded. Moreover, measurements of the size of Greenland suggest that it is shrinking by over 1,000 gigatons of ice since 2003, particularly at its coastal margins. Other evidence for global warming. Other evidence for global warming comes from permafrost regions and weather patterns such as certain storm records. Permafrost exists in high latitude and high altitude areas where it is so cold that the ground is frozen solid to a great depth. During the summer months, only the top meter or so of the permafrost becomes warm enough to melt, and this is called the active layer. Already in Alaska, there seems to have been a 3 degrees Celsius warming down to at least a meter over the last 50 years, showing that the active layer has become deeper. The maximum area cover by seasonal ground has decreased by 7% in the Northern Hemisphere since 1900, with a decrease in the spring of up to 15%. With the massive increases in atmospheric CO2 predicted for the future, it is likely that there will be increases in the thickness of the active layer of the permafrost, or perhaps in some areas, the complete disappearance of so-called discontinuous permafrost over the next century. This widespread loss of permafrost will produce a huge range of problems in local areas, as it will trigger erosion or subsidence, change hydrologic processes, and release into the atmosphere even more CO2 and methane trapped as organic matter in the frozen layers. Hence, changes in permafrost will reduce the stability of slopes and thus increase incidence of slides and avalanches. A more dynamic cryosphere will increase the natural hazards for people, structures, and communication links. Already, buildings, roads, pipelines, such as the oil pipelines in Alaska, and communication links are under threat. There is evidence, too, that our weather patterns are changing. For example, in recent years, massive storms and subsequent floods have hit China, Italy, England, Korea, Bangladesh, Venezuela, and Mozambique. In England, in 2000, floods classified as once-in-30-years events occurred twice in the same month. Moreover, in Britain, the winter of 2000 to 2001 was the wettest 6 months since records began in the 18th century. August 2008 was the wettest on record. And British birds nest 12 plus or minus 4 days earlier than 30 years previously. Insect species, including bees and termites, that need warm weather to survive, are moving northward, and some have already reached England by crossing the Channel from France. While in the summer of 2003, 35,000 people died from an extreme heat wave in northern Europe, during which 100 degrees Fahrenheit was recorded for the first time ever in Britain. In addition, glaciers in Europe are in retreat, particularly in the Alps and Iceland. Ice cover records from the Tornio River in Finland, which have been compiled since 1693, show that the spring thaw of the frozen river now occurs a month earlier. There is also evidence that more storms are occurring in the northern hemisphere. Wave height in the North Atlantic Ocean has been monitored since the early 1950s from lightships, ocean weather stations, and more recently, satellites. Between the 1950s and 1990s, the average wave height increased from 2.5 meters to 3.5 meters, an increase of 40%. Storm intensity is the major determinant of wave height, which provides evidence for an increase in storm activity over the last 40 years. This also fits with the observed increase in winter extratropical cyclones, that is, those occurring in the mid-latitudes, which have increased markedly over the last 100 years, with significant rises in both the Pacific and Atlantic sectors since the early 1970s. There is also evidence for an increase in intense tropical hurricane activity since the 1970s in the North Atlantic. What do the skeptics say? One of the best ways to summarize the evidence for global warming and to persuade you that there is evidence that humanity has already altered global climate is to review what the skeptics say against the global warming hypothesis. 1. Ice core data suggest atmospheric carbon dioxide responds to global temperature. Therefore, atmospheric carbon dioxide cannot cause global temperature changes. A detailed examination of the ice core carbon dioxide data at the end of the last glacial period shows that the major stepwise increases occur at the same time as warming in Antarctica. It is known that during the last deglaciation, gradual warming in Antarctica occurred before step-like warming in the northern hemisphere. There is, therefore, excellent evidence that atmospheric carbon dioxide increases before overall global temperatures rise and the ice sheets begin to melt. In fact, there is clear evidence that Antarctic temperatures and atmospheric carbon dioxide levels are in step, demonstrating the central role of carbon dioxide as a climate amplifier. Moreover, time series analysis of the last four glacial-interglacial cycles by the late Professor Sir Shackleton at the University of Cambridge suggests atmospheric carbon dioxide response up to 5,000 years before variations in global ice sheets. This has prompted many paleoclimatologists to reevaluate the role of atmospheric carbon dioxide, placing it now as a primary driving force of past climate instead of a secondary response and feedback. 2. Every data set showing global warming has been corrected or tweaked to achieve this desired result. For people who are not regularly involved in science, this seems to be the biggest problem with the whole global warming has happened argument. As I have shown, all the data sets covering the last 150 years require some sort of adjustment. This, though, is part of the scientific process. For example, if great care had not been taken over the spurious trends in the global precipitation database, we would now assume that global precipitation was increasing. Moreover, as science moves forward incrementally, it gains more and more understanding and insight into the data sets it is constructing. This constant questioning of all data and interpretations is the core strength of science. Each new correction or adjustment is due to a greater understanding of the data and the climate system, and thus each new study adds to the confidence that we have in the results. This is why the IPCC report refers to the weight of the evidence, since our confidence in science increases if similar results are obtained from very different sources. 3. Solar output and sunspot activity control the past temperatures. This is something both the skeptics and non-skeptics agree upon. Of course, sunspots and also volcanic activity have influenced past temperatures. For example, the cooling of the 1960s and 1970s is clearly linked to changes in the sunspot cycle. The difference between the two camps is that the skeptics put more weight on the importance of these natural variations. Though great care has been taken to understand how the minor variations in solar output affect global climate, this is still one of the areas which contain many unknowns and uncertainties. However, climate models combining our current state-of-the-art knowledge concerning all radiative forcing, including greenhouse gases and sunspots, are able to simulate the global temperature curve for the last 130 years. The separate natural and anthropogenic forcing on global climate for the last 130 years and the combination of the two can also be shown. This provides confidence in both models and also an understanding of the relative influence of natural versus anthropogenic forcing. 4. Satellite data cast doubt on the models. Again, before the satellite data were clearly understood, they did suggest that over the last 25 years there had been a slight cooling. The iterative process of science, the re-examination of data and assumptions concerning the data, clearly showed that there were some major inconsistencies within the satellite data. First, as a result of trying to compare the data from different instruments on different satellites. And second, because of the need to adjust the altitude of the satellite as its orbit shrinks as a result of friction with the atmosphere. The final problem with the satellite data is that 20 years is just too short a time period to find a temperature trend with any confidence. This is because climatic cycles or events will have a major influence on the record and will not be averaged out. For example, the sunspot cycle is 11 years. El Niño Southern Oscillation is 3 to 7 years, and the North Atlantic Oscillation is 10 years. So, which of these cycles is picked up by the 20-year satellite data will strongly